has tried to define its own relationship with God. And this small mosque in Isfahan, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, is a masterpiece of symbolizing that relationship. The flooring of the mosque is in blue, and the color of the dome is in the color of the earth. The architect has tried to symbolize that connection in the most beautiful way, the transcendence of human soul and the omnipresence of God.
And yes, he is transcendent, because if I create a chair, I don't really become the chair, do I? There is some distinctness between me and the chair. However, because I made the chair, I have intimate knowledge of it, and God has intimate knowledge of us. And therefore, that's what we mean by his closeness. But we also mean by his closeness from a spiritual perspective, because the more we worship, the more we love him and do good things for his sake, not for the ego, not for social pressure, not for the bling-bling culture or materialism, but for him alone. That brings us closer to him too.
Something within us alerts us to the possibility of a higher purpose, a higher meaning. And to me, that higher meaning is our connection with the divine.
Indeed, the creation is the manifestation of God's beauties at different levels. And if that is the case, how could he be absent from the creation? His attributes have filled the foundations of everything. Hence, nothing is depleted of him while he transcends everything.
God is beyond space, time, and matter. So he's not contained or limited to any specific object or any specific location. What can be said is the attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is what is out there in creation.
The most heavily emphasized or most predominant attribute that we find in the Muslim and Quranic description of God is the attribute of Rahmah, commonly translated as God's mercy. But this doesn't seem to capture the Muslim sense and the Quranic sense of the word mercy. Mercy doesn't encapsulate Rahmah. Rahmah is something much more. Mercy is given to somebody who's done something wrong. Okay? It's where somebody has trespassed one's right, we give them mercy. Okay? But the concept of mercy in the Quran seems to be much, much stronger than this. And as I said, it's the predominant attribute of God described in the Quran.
The Quran doesn't use the term sifat or attributes for God. Maybe because he is so transcendent that we cannot ascribe any attribute to him. Rather, it uses the term asma, names. Name is something which alludes to something else, and Asma'ullah, or his names, manifest him from different angles.
It's interesting that when someone, in just culture, in language, when you know someone famous for something, then it sort of becomes their name. You know, so sometimes you can even call it a nickname. In other words, names are attributed to people beyond their original name. Names are attributed to them for something they do all the time, or something they do really, really well.
In fact, if we think about it deeper, we realize that God's attributes, or his names, as the Quran calls them, are infinite. An infinity of qualities which has filled the world with beauty and majesty.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain's early handling of the coronavirus pandemic was one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history, with ministers and scientists taking a fatalistic approach that exacerbated the death toll, a landmark inquiry has found. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Ian Sample and Peter Walker. The piece is titled COVID Response, One of UK's Worst Ever Public Health Failures. Britain's early handling of the coronavirus pandemic was one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history, with ministers and scientists taking a fatalistic approach that exacerbated the death toll, a landmark inquiry has found. Groupthink, evidence of British exceptionalism, and a deliberately slow and gradualist approach meant the United Kingdom fared significantly worse than other countries, according to a 151-page Coronavirus Lessons Learned to Date report led by two former Conservative ministers. The crisis exposed major deficiencies in the machinery of government, with public bodies unable to share vital information and scientific advice impaired by a lack of transparency, input from international experts, and meaningful challenge. Despite being one of the first countries to develop a test for COVID in January of 2020, the United Kingdom squandered its lead and converted it into one of permanent crisis. The consequences were profound, the report says. For a country with a world-class expertise in data analysis to face the biggest health crisis in 100 years with virtually no data to analyze was an almost unimaginable setback. Prime Minister Boris Johnson did not order a complete lockdown until 23rd of March 2020, 2 months after the government's SAGE committee of scientific advisers first met to discuss the crisis. This slow and gradualist approach was not inadvertent, nor did it reflect bureaucratic delay or disagreement between ministers and their advisers. It was a deliberate policy proposed by official scientific advisers and adopted by the governments of all of the nations of the United Kingdom, the report says. It is now clear that this was the wrong policy and that it led to a higher initial death toll than would have resulted from a more emphatic early policy. In a pandemic spreading rapidly and exponentially, every week counted. Decisions on lockdowns and social distancing during the early weeks of the pandemic and the advice that led to them rank as one of the most important public health failures the United Kingdom has ever experienced, the report concludes. The report stresses this happened despite the United Kingdom counting on some of the best expertise available anywhere in the world, and despite having an open, democratic system that allowed plentiful challenge. The report from the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee and the Health and Social Care Committee draws on evidence from more than 50 witnesses, including the former Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, the government's chief scientific and medical advisers, and leading figures from the Vaccine Task Force and NHS Test and Trace. It celebrates some aspects of Britain's COVID response, in particular the rapid development, approval and delivery of vaccines, and the world-leading recovery trial that identified life-saving treatments, but is highly critical of other areas. Some of the most serious and early failings, the report suggests, result from apparent groupthink among scientists and ministers, which led to fatalism. Greg Clark, the chair of the Science and Technology Committee, said he dismissed the allegation that government policy sought to reach herd immunity through infection, but the outcome came to be seen as the only viable option. It was more a reflection of fatalism, Greg Clark said, that if you don't have the prospect of a vaccine being developed, if you think people won't obey instructions to lock down for very long and have a wholly inadequate ability to test, trace and isolate people, that is what you are left with. The impossibility of suppressing the virus was only challenged, the MPs say, when it became clear the National Health Service could be overwhelmed. The report questions why international experts were not part of the UK scientific advisory process and why measures that worked in other countries were not brought in as a precaution, as a response was hammered out. While Public Health England told the MPs it had formally studied and rejected the South Korean approach, no evidence was provided despite repeated requests. We must conclude that no formal evaluation took place, which amounts to an extraordinary and negligent omission given South Korea's success in containing the pandemic, which was well publicized at the time, the report says. The MPs said the government's decision to halt mass testing in March of 2020, days after the World Health Organization called for painstaking contact tracing and rigorous quarantine of close contacts, was a serious mistake. When the test, trace and isolate system was rolled out, it was slow, uncertain and often chaotic, ultimately failed in its stated objective to prevent future lockdowns, and severely hampered Britain's response to the pandemic. The problem was compounded, the report adds, by the failure of public bodies to share data, including between national and local governments. Further criticism is levelled at poor protection in care homes for Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups and for people with learning disabilities. Professor Trish Greenhalgh of University of Oxford said the report hinted at a less than healthy relationship between government and its scientific advisory bodies. It would appear that even senior government ministers were reluctant to push back on scientific advice that seemed to go against common sense interpretations of the unfolding crisis, she said. It would appear that SAGE, COBRA, Public Health England and other bodies repeatedly dismissed the precautionary principle in favour of not taking decisive action until definitive evidence emerged and could be signed off as the truth. Jonathan Ashworth, the Shadow Health Secretary, said the report was damning. Hannah Brady of the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice Group said the report found the deaths of 150,000 people were redeemed by the success of the vaccine rollout. The report is laughable and more interested in political arguments about whether you can bring laptops to Cobra meetings than it is in the experiences of those who tragically lost parents, partners, or children to COVID-19. This is an attempt to ignore and gaslight bereaved families who will see it as a slap in the face, she said.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir Group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know very clear, it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they tried to disrupt Iraq and Syria and tried to cause a major stabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Afghanistan's authorities to punish the perpetrators behind the Friday terrorist attack targeting worshippers at a packed Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The bitter, tragic incident involving a blast at the mosque of Khanabad district of Kunduz province, which resulted in the deaths of a large number of faithful worshippers, saddened us. Authorities in the neighboring and brotherly country of Afghanistan are seriously expected to punish the bloodthirsty perpetrators of this heinous crime and take necessary measures to prevent a recurrence of such tragedies. In fact, Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for several attacks in Afghanistan in recent weeks. This has put the Taliban under pressure because the newly formed rule vowed to provide safety for Afghans when it took power in August. Therefore, the Taliban has vowed to find and punish the perpetrators. They also have destroyed a cell belonging to Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, recently.
You know, we're hoping that the Taliban will make the right moves and treat this as a terrorist attack on its people. And this obviously shows a sign of weakness for the Taliban if they do not prosecute these criminals and these terrorists. And it shows that there is an open door, an open hand to, attack people inside of Afghanistan. And that show a bad sign for Afghanistan's new administration. So if they really want to show, strength, and they want to show unity, and they want to show that they are in control, they must prosecute these criminals, and also to stop further attacks like this that could cause, sectarian problems as well in the whole region.
Former Afghan President Hamid Karzai had once said in an interview that the U.S. is colluding with Daesh in Afghanistan and allowing the Takfiris to flourish in the conflict-stricken country. In addition, many U.S. officials have confessed to Washington being responsible for Daesh's creation. Now that this unholy child of Washington's flawed policies in the Middle East is causing trouble, it's likely that we are going to see a major confrontation between Daesh and the Taliban in near future. Britain grapples with a full-blown crisis. Labor shortages, truck drivers in particular, have disrupted supply chain activities and caused several problems. The significant lack of drivers meant deliveries of fuel and food were falling short. As a result, the country witnessed panic buying of fuel and some goods dwindled. These events triggered chaotic scenes across major cities, leading to long lines at gas stations and fistfights among drivers. Also, many factories and businesses are struggling with rising energy bills. They are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. In fact, the crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. The British government is now under fire for its handling of the crisis. So, being under intense pressure, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the trucking industry for Britain's supply chain mess. The industry called Johnson's claims wrong and pointed to the government's immigration policy and delays in testing and certifying new drivers as the main culprits. The government also claimed there is a global shortage of drivers. However, the European countries have not faced a similar problem. Britain faces a shortfall of 100,000 drivers. 20% of those are drivers who departed Britain after the country voted to leave the European Union. In addition, about 200,000 EU citizens left Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. So, how does the British government address the crisis? By introducing a short-term visa program. But by offering short-term visas to foreign truckers, the British government is admitting that exiting the EU was a decisive factor in the current crisis. In addition, many people are reluctant to uproot themselves and move to Britain for temporary and difficult work while they have better options in EU member state countries.
It's a crisis of the free market, a triumph of the free market. The government abandoned regulation, it abandoned public ownership, so it's private ownership. So we're depending for energy in Britain on people who make lots of profits out of energy shortages. So, if it's to someone's advantage to see gas and electricity prices shoot up, then they're going to go up. They're not going to say, oh, we're not going to take profits because it's bad for the economy. They're going to say, hey, send me more.
Households that spend a high proportion of their income on energy bills are considered to be in fuel poverty. Currently, 4 million people in Britain are already in fuel poverty, while up to 1.5 additional British households won't be able to afford to heat and power their homes. Last October, the government raised the energy price cap to control the sharply rising wholesale gas prices. The cap limits the impact of soaring energy prices on British households. The UK energy regulator said that the price cap must rise again next year if wholesale gas prices continue to go up. This could mean a typical customer paying between £400 and £600 more annually. That's while natural gas prices are at record highs as economies around the world begin to recover from the COVID crisis.
The government in Britain has recently cut back on the minimum payments for welfare and support for all sorts of people, from unemployed to underpaid to pensioners. So a lot of the apparatus that was very leaky, the very leaky safety net we already had in Britain has been torn up, and the government has decided that people, as a matter of conscious policy, they think that people only go to work if they're starving, so they're trying to starve people. And that includes freezing them. Freezing and starving will get them to work, is what they think.
The price rises had already pushed 500,000 more households into fuel poverty. Unable to pay heating and energy costs, these low-income families are at a great risk. Many actually die every year because they can't afford to heat their homes. In fact, 8,500 people died in England and Wales last winter due to cold homes. All in all, the British government should stop blaming others and start cleaning up the mess it is responsible for.
In another sign of growing tensions in ties between Washington and Beijing, the United States Central Intelligence Agency announced the formation of a group that would focus exclusively on China. The CIA argued in a statement that the China Mission Center aims at addressing what it called global challenges to the U.S. competitiveness posed by the People's Republic of China. According to the U.S. spy agency, those issues include emerging technologies, economic security, climate change, and health.
The real threat that China poses that the United States is referring to is the ability to undermine the empire. And when we see that right now, that there's definitely a global shift going on, which is starting to move from the West towards the East, of which China is the main power in this situation.
The announcement comes amid a wider prioritization by the administration of President Joe Biden on countering Beijing. In June, Biden announced a new task force at the Pentagon to assess and respond to Beijing's military challenge. The United States and China remain at odds over several issues, including the situation in Hong Kong, U.S. relations with Taiwan, trade, commerce, and a disputed South China Sea. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In the case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing. Top U.S. counterintelligence officials have reportedly warned that a concerning number of CIA informants are being captured and executed. According to the New York Times, the warning came in a top-secret memo the officials issued to all of the CIA stations and bases around the world last week. The memo suggests that the agency's Counterintelligence Mission Center looked at dozens of cases in the last several years involving foreign informants who had been killed, arrested, or most likely compromised. The cable itself was not necessarily unique, but as the Times notes, announcing the specific number of killings is rare, as the information is usually kept strictly under wraps by intelligence officials.
And this has been something that was significant enough that it was leaked into the mainstream media where it was reported on. It seems the United States sees this as possibly a potential crisis and something they need to reinforce with more bodies.
According to the Times, recruiting spies has always been highly risky. However, the cable warned that the CIA has not excelled in the area recently for reasons that include being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign intelligence agencies, and moving too quickly to recruit informants while ignoring potential risks.
It's frankly acknowledged that everybody is spying on everybody else because everybody needs to know what their competitor is doing with regards to their stance towards them and what plans they have, etc. So in this regards, the United States is not doing anything new, nothing that it has ever done before. But the main bulwark of this, the main reason this is happening, is the U.S. is trying to expand its current intelligence network.
The report says that the uptick in the compromised informants highlights the growing prowess of other countries in employing innovations like biometric scans, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, and hacking tools to track the movements of CIA officers in order to discover the sources. The memo suggested that the U.S. spy agency overestimated its capacities and underestimated its adversaries. The results show that countries targeted by U.S. espionage are becoming more capable of exposing agents than ever before.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Thousands of school districts across the United States have installed surveillance software on school-provided devices to monitor their students' online interactions. We now present you an article written by Jessa Crispin. The piece is titled, U.S. Schools Gave Kids Laptops During the Pandemic, Then They Spied on Them. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. When the coronavirus pandemic started 2 years ago, countless forms of inequality were exposed, including the millions of American families who don't have access to laptops or broadband internet. After some delays, schools across the country jumped into action and distributed technology to allow students to learn remotely. The catch? They ended up spying on their students. For their own good, of course. According to recent research by the Center for Democracy and Technology, the CDT, teachers reported that during the pandemic, schools provided tablets, laptops, or Chromebooks to students at twice the rate, 43%, prior to the pandemic. An illustration of schools' attempts to supposedly close disparities in digital access. The problem is, a lot of those electronics were being used to monitor students, even combing through private chats, emails, and documents, all in the name of protecting them. More than 80% of surveyed teachers and 77% of surveyed high school students told the Center for Democracy and Technology, the CDT, that their schools use surveillance software on those devices, and the more reliant students are on those electronics, unable to afford supplementary phones or tablets the more they are subjected to scrutiny. A school administrator explained to the Center for Democracy and Technology, the CDT, researchers. The school administrator said, "We knew that there were students out there having ideas around suicide, self-harm, and those sorts of things. We found this student activity monitoring software. We could also do a good job with students who might be thinking about bullying. If I can save one student from committing suicide, I feel like that platform is well worth every dime that we paid for it." Thousands of school districts across the United States have installed surveillance software on school-provided devices to monitor their students' online interactions and activities. If a student emails or chats with another student saying they've been thinking of hurting themselves or that there is trouble at home, an artificial intelligence bot or a human moderator watching over the messages in real time can send an alert to a teacher or administrator, allowing the teacher to jump in within minutes and ask if everything is okay. These programs, such as Bark, Gnosis IQ, Gaggle, and Lightspeed, can cost the schools tens of thousands of dollars to implement, and they can be set up to purportedly search for language and online behavior indicating the possibility of violent tendencies, suicidal ideas, drug use, etc. I can certainly understand why schools would jump on technology they think might prevent teen suicide, bullying, and the like. The pandemic has been hard on everyone, and increased isolation and uncertainty is particularly hard on kids and teenagers. Students are reporting an increase in self-harm incidents and aggressive impulses since the beginning of the lockdowns, and shoving everyone back together for a new school year is going to require adjustments. The only problem is that we've tried this before in a different form. Everyone's proposed solution to the advent of school shootings was, well, let's just watch these little deviants much more closely. Metal detectors at the entrance to schools became the norm. Police had a more visible presence at schools, and security cameras went up in classrooms and hallways. That was a big business. Schools spend billions of dollars on security infrastructure that mostly proved to be ineffective. And the results were, well, you'll never guess. Kids felt unsafe. Black students were followed and harassed most frequently. And punishments increased as educational outcomes worsened. And while some schools have started questioning whether their contacts with the police create more harm than good, others are simply adding digital surveillance to their physical systems. If students' references to drug use or violent thoughts might be forwarded to law enforcement, it will be, as usual, the kids already subjected to a greater number of interactions with police and social workers and other forms of monitoring and punishment who will suffer the increased attention. Although schools and parents are quick to voice concerns over privacy, it remains unclear whether the result of all of this monitoring is safety. And if so, safety for whom? Safer for students? Surveys suggest that students are mostly aware they are being monitored, but are not fully cognizant of the extent of the monitoring. Many of these programs boast that teachers have direct access to the screens of their students, even after school hours are over. Teachers and administrators can hijack control of the computers remotely, closing problematic tabs and overriding their keyboards. Does that make kids feel safe? Then there is the tricky question of the promise of intervention. According to the software companies, the goal of the surveillance is to supposedly allow for a problem to be spotted and intervened with early on. That intervention can lead to the presence of police and social workers, each with their own difficult histories when it comes to involvement in private homes. And information about the child's attempts to access outside help might be forwarded to their possible abuser, their parents. The Rape Abuse Incest National Network reported that during the pandemic, more than half of their callers seeking assistance and counsel were children and minors, who were more likely to be trapped in their homes with abusive family members under stressful circumstances. The software company's other big promise about monitoring children for problems is that mental health professionals can be alerted and services provided. But again, the outcomes for mental health care with children varies widely. Children with Medicaid coverage are more likely to be prescribed antipsychotics and other debilitating medication than get access to talk therapy. It is not clear whether students are going to benefit from this surveillance, or if it is merely going to reduce schools' liability when an act of violence or self-harm takes place. If teenagers are in need of help, it seems obvious that the best way to protect them is to ensure that they have trusted adults in their lives they can turn to. A snooping artificial intelligence program is no substitute for that.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today's Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babish, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent €19 million using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrei Babish behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled the report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, you know, by those, you know, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lots of money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, the elderly people,
we are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world, and I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not, don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we are going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, keep it in the ground. Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue. That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially. World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head-on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes and houses. I make good money and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves, and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
London is now hosting the biggest and most expensive Islamic exhibit, which focuses its entire attention to the life and legacy of the cousin and son-in-law of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad. The Imam Ali exhibit takes viewers on an interactive journey through the life of Ali ibn Abi Talib, whose loyal service helped create a lasting and perfect religion. Imam Ali is beloved